Count one, aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously agree that the prosecution has proved the following circumstance or circumstances regarding count one beyond a reasonable doubt. The homicide was committed for pecuniary gain, and the homicide was committed by means of the administration of any substance administered in a lethal amount, dosage, or quantity. Count two, attempted aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of attempted aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously agree the prosecution has proved the following circumstance or circumstances regarding count two beyond a reasonable doubt. The attempted homicide was committed for pecuniary gain. Count three, insurance fraud. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of insurance fraud. Count four, insurance fraud. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of insurance fraud. Count five, forgery. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of forgery. It's signed by the four personnel. Please have a seat. Madam Foreperson, is this the verdict that the jury reached unanimously?
Yes, it is.
Okay, you may have a seat. Ms. Lewis, Ms. Nestor, do you wish the jury to be polled?
Yes, please.
All right. Folks, I'll ask you the same yes or no question, one at a time, starting on my left, working this way. Front row first, if you could show me your lanyard number as I ask you. Juror number five, is this the verdict you voted in favor of?
Yes.
Juror number four, is this the verdict you voted in favor of?
Yes.
Juror number three?
Yes.
I can't see your norm, so sorry. The four person, I just need to ask you again, I'm sorry. Juror number two?
Yes.
Juror number one.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sir. Juror number eight.
Yes.
Juror number seven.
Yes.
Juror number six.
Yes.
All right. Counsel, is there anything further on this case before the jury is discharged? Mr. Bloodworth.
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Lewis.
No, Your Honor.
Well, there you have it. Corey Richens has been found guilty in the murder of her husband, in the poisoning death of her husband, as well as the attempted murder that took place on Valentine's Day with the sandwich. So the jury obviously bought all of the theories that the state provided. The defense, as I have said before, did not call any witnesses, which I think might have been a grave mistake given how things turned out. But I want to talk about the closing arguments and then what her sentence could potentially be, and just exactly what happened in court yesterday, because it was obviously a crazy day. The day started with closing arguments. Bloodworth went first. He started out kind of sympathetic, you know, saying that, you know, Corey's parents really sucked. She had a, sorry, I'm not laughing. But I am laughing. Okay, I'm going to actually leave that in because I'm not laughing that she had rough parents. Obviously, people have rough parents or rough childhoods and they don't murder their husbands. Like, you guys know that I had a rough relationship with my mom and I'm not out here poisoning Austin, you know, because I want his money. Like, that's exactly what Corey did. He went through her relationship with Eric, how they met, that he was a successful business owner who had money, that they had three sons, but that Corey wanted to leave Eric, just not his money. Their prenup meant that if she left him, she'd also leave most of his money. And so she took $250,000 in equity out of Eric's home without him knowing so that she could start her own business and earn enough money to leave Eric. And he said, Corey Richens is intensely ambitious. Throughout the closing arguments, he repeated, Corey Richens is intensely ambitious, probably 5 to 10 times. I mean, it was something he obviously really wanted to get through to them. So again, he started out focusing on Corey's financial collapse, pointing out that she had accumulated millions of dollars in debt through her house flipping business. And at the time that Eric died, her financial situation was collapsing and she was struggling to keep projects afloat. Prosecutors said that she believed Eric's death would allow her to inherit money and collect life insurance payouts worth roughly $2 million. He reminded jurors that divorce would not have solved her financial problems because of that prenup that Eric had in place. So in other words, if she just left him, she wouldn't have gotten much, which obviously points to her motive. But if Eric were to die, the situation changed dramatically, even though she didn't know that he had changed the will and the structure of the trust, essentially. Next, Bloodworth reminded the jury of the relationship with Josh Grossman, the handyman that she had been having an affair with. Jurors had already seen text messages between the two during trial, but Brad Bloodworth highlighted several of them again in closing, one of them that said, "If he could just go away and you could just be here, life would be perfect." Bloodworth argued that those text messages revealed what Corey really wanted, a life with Josh Grossman instead of Eric. He also reminded jurors of the messages sent after Eric died, including sending Josh a link to that luxury resort that she had purchased a trip for them to go on, and telling him weeks later that she thought she wanted him to be her husband. Those are not conversations you have when you're a grieving widow. Now, according to the prosecutor, those messages showed that Eric's death cleared the path for the relationship that she wanted. This romantic trip, she booked it knowing he would not be alive by the time of the trip. That has always been a sticking point for me that has pointed to her guilt, because how on earth was she planning to go on this trip and leave her husband and 3 sons behind to go on this romantic getaway if Eric were still going to be alive? She booked it, in my opinion, knowing that he was not going to be alive by the time that trip took place. Then Bloodworth walked the jury step by step through the prosecution's timeline of the poisoning. The key witness in this part of the case was Carmen Lauber, obviously the house cleaner who testified that she bought pills for Corey. She asked 2 separate people for the Michael Jackson stuff. I'm saying Corey asked 2 separate people, including Carmen Lauber and someone else, for the Michael Jackson stuff. So these 2 people having this, you know, quote in their repertoire, like, she asked me for the Michael Jackson stuff. That's not random. And that's not a coincidence. I think it points to the truth, obviously. So according to Carmen, Corey asked her to find pain pills for an investor. That's another sticking point that I had, that if the defense really wanted to fight up against this or like prove Corey's innocence, bring up the investor. Who was this investor that you were getting pills for if not for your husband? So then Carmen eventually obtained pills that turned out to be fentanyl, or contained fentanyl at least, and delivered those pills to Corey multiple times. And again, Bloodworth played footage of Robert Crozier, the man who supplied Carmen with the pills, saying she knew those pills had fentanyl. And, you know, remember, the defense wanted to bring in some testimony, but that would have opened up the door for the state to bring in testimony where someone had texted Carmen, or Carmen texted someone saying that she had just made a bunch of money off of selling fentanyl. So they all knew that this medicine, these pills, contained fentanyl. So this whole like, oh, we had no idea. She bought oxycodone. That was her intent. We didn't know it was laced with fentanyl. She knew. It's what she wanted. So again, Bloodworth reminded jurors that phone data supported this timeline, including hundreds of text messages between Corey and Carmen, location records showing travel that was connected to those pickups. Remember that gas station, the Maverick in Draper? There was GPS data taken from the phones that showed Carmen and Robert Crozier both at the gas station within the same time frame, only on the times that they were exchanging pills to get for Corey. No other time. So obviously that must have, you know, really stuck with the jury as well. Then Bloodworth moved on to another major point, which was the Valentine's Day incident. He reminded jurors that Eric became extremely sick after eating a sandwich that Corey got for him on Valentine's Day. According to testimony during the trial, he had passed out for 90 minutes and later described feeling extremely disoriented. And remember, we also heard from some of his friends that said when they spoke to him later that day, he sounded really scared and just kind of out of it. And so obviously there was something he ate that really messed him up. This was not just a typical allergic reaction. Then Bloodworth moved on to the night that Eric died, focusing on the early morning hours of March 3rd into the 4th of 2022. Prosecutors believe this whole time that Corey served Eric a Moscow Mule drink that contained fentanyl. He reminded jurors of the toxicology evidence showing a massive amount of fentanyl in Eric's system. He argued that amount could not have been accidental. Digital evidence also played a role in this portion of the closing argument. And according to investigators, Corey's phone was active during the early morning hours. The device showed movement inside the house before 911 was called. In fact, he pointed out that the phone was unlocked at 3:06 a.m., but that the 911 call did not come in until 3:21 a.m. He suggested that that gap raises questions about what was happening in the house during those minutes. Now, I know that everything in the closing arguments has essentially been hashed out during the last 3 weeks. Obviously, this is just a way to condense it in a way that is easy to remember and understand when you look at just the big picture. This is kind of like the trailer of the big picture. And so I understand the purpose in it because you can kind of get lost in the weeds when you're going through trials with all the bureaucratic stuff, the paperwork, the laying foundation, all of the things. It's like it's easy to kind of lose sight of the real true picture. So we're kind of zooming out. And I think that's important because it reminds the jurors of exactly why the state believes Corey is guilty. Next, he moves on to the children's book near the end of his closing argument. The book was written to help children cope with grief, and it widely became known during the investigation. This book was called Are You With Me? And it was basically this book about children losing a parent. And, you know, Corey argued that she couldn't find any books, any children's books on losing a parent or dealing with grief. And so she chose to write one and she wrote it all by herself, except she used a ghostwriter, but, which is fine. I'm not like crapping on ghostwriters. It's just, you can't claim that you wrote the book 100% all by yourself if you actually had help. So anyway, I think that was just another thing to point to her incredibility. So let's see, the last final message to the jury was basically emphasizing that the case was built on many pieces of evidence that all point in the same direction. And yes, a lot of it is circumstantial, but he showed this elephant standing against a wall with a man standing behind the elephant. And there is feces all over the wall, but there's an outline of a male figure or a human figure on the wall that obviously did not have poop on it. And so the point was to say, like, we all know what happened here, right? You don't need to actually see it happen to know what happened here, which I just kind of thought was a funny moment. But he acknowledged that there's no video of the poisoning. You know, he reminded jurors that usually most murder cases rely on circumstantial evidence because people don't video themselves committing these crimes. So his argument was that when jurors would take a look at everything together, the debt, the affair, the drug purchases, the toxicology, and the phone evidence, the conclusion is unavoidable. According to Bloodworth, the evidence showed Corey wanted out of the marriage, she needed money, she obtained fentanyl, and Eric died after ingesting it in their home. He told the jury that when all of those facts are placed together, the story becomes very clear that Eric did not die by accident. He was murdered. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing, homeschooling. And if you're in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day. You can focus on one
one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days, you're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons. But you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That, again, is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's timeforlearning.com.
At Great Wolf Lodge, there's adventure for the whole family. You and your pack can splash away in the indoor water park where it's always 84 degrees. There's a massive wave pool, a lazy river, and tons of water slides for your pack to enjoy together. And the fun doesn't stop there. Get ready to explore and play at adventure-packed attractions from Magi Quest, a live-action game that takes place throughout the lodge to the Northern Lights Arcade. There's also a bunch of great dining options and complimentary daily events like nightly dance parties, all under one roof. And the best part? With 22 lodges across the country, you're always only a short drive away from adventure. So bring your pack together at a lodge near you. Book your stay today at greatwolf.com and strengthen the pack.
So after that, they take a recess, the jury leaves the room, and at this point, so I should back up a little bit, because during their closing arguments for the state, at one point, the defense tried to object, which you can't do. You cannot interrupt opening statements or closing arguments. And so at one point, I believe it was either Wendy or, well, I guess Catherine, but they objected. And they, as they began to say their objection, the judge just interrupted and said, "Overruled, sit down." And it was a kind of a tense moment. But it's like, do you guys not know how just common courtroom decorum? Like, you guys are attorneys. I thought you should know this better than anybody. So anyway, during the break, Nestor brought this objection back up. And the jury is not present, but Nestor at this point moved for a mistrial because she wants instruction given to the jurors that you cannot comment on how a defendant looks while they are being silent at the defense table. Because that was one of the things that Brad Bloodworth said during his closing arguments was, look at her. She's been stoic this whole time. She hasn't showed any emotion the whole time she's been sitting there. So they wanted the judge to give an instruction to the jury that they don't need to consider that. And the judge pushed back and was like, I don't think that that's warranted, because if, you know, she had burst out laughing when there was talk about her husband's dead body being found, then the jury should be able to look at that and, you know, let that shape their feelings about the case, right? And at that point, Catherine Nestor like puts her hand to her chest and she's like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And he was like, "It was a hypothetical." And she was like, oh my gosh, okay, because, oh man, I would have thought, wow, that would be horrible. She never laughed. And he's like, "Okay, please stay focused." And then her attitude totally switches to, "I am focused. I just misheard you." And it was just like, oh my God, this is embarrassing, because you can tell that Nestor's trying to appeal to this judge and maybe appeal to whoever else is in the courtroom and make light of a moment. And the judge is basically no nonsense and he's just not having it. And he's like, just shut up and move on. You know, like you can tell that he's just over it. So next it was time for the defense's closing arguments. Basically, they started out with, you know, how do people grieve? There's portrayals of grief in art. And they had this really bad depiction. It was like a black screen with three statues of women that are supposedly in grief, and you know, they're all sitting the same way with their heads down, and they show this picture of Corey the night that Eric died on the body cam footage, sitting on the floor with her head down, and you know, she's basically in the same posture as these historical pieces of art depicting grief, right? Wendy Lewis is actually the one that delivered the defense's closing argument. And from the get, I don't know if you saw it. If you watched it, you'll know what I'm talking about. But she got up there and she already has like a really shrill voice that kind of sounds like nails on a chalkboard, unfortunately. It just sounds like she's constantly overcoming a cold or something. So the first thing she does, she tries to talk and her voice cracks. So she has to clear her throat. And the whole time she's talking, it just sounds like she needs to clear her throat. And it's very distracting. And I don't know if anyone else picked up on that, but I was just like, could they have not had Nestor do this closing argument? Because I don't want to listen to this woman talk. Regardless, she kept on and basically said that the state has built a story, but not proof. From the start, she reminded jurors of the standard that they must apply when deliberating. She emphasized repeatedly that the prosecution carries the burden of proof, saying things like the burden is on the state to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Their job is not to prove it. It's the state's job, which I think it was her roundabout way of trying to relay why they didn't call any witnesses. So again, Lewis explained that the concept of reasonable doubt doesn't require jurors to know exactly what happened, only that there are other reasonable explanations for Eric's death. And if those explanations exist, then the law requires a not guilty verdict. All right, I think she was kind of trying to take a page out of Jose Baez's book, but it didn't work because obviously now we know the jurors didn't buy it, but she still went through reconstructing the night that Eric died. She began her argument by walking the jury through those early morning hours, saying basically that, you know, the sounds you hear on this 911 call are of a woman becoming a widow. And it was probably supposed to feel dramatic and like really impactful, but it just wasn't landing given everything that we've known since. Like the way that she behaved was anything but a grieving widow. So just because you're playing this overdramatic 911 call where she clearly tries to feign sorrow, you know, like there's no real tears. It's just her voice is really like this. And it's like, that doesn't really do it for me. I'm not buying it. According to Lewis, though, Corey says she climbed into bed that night and noticed something unusual. Something felt wrong. Corey turned on the light, looked at Eric, realized he wasn't breathing, and, you know, described that moment dramatically to the jurors, saying in that moment, Corey Richens' world collapsed. And the defense wanted jurors to see Corey not as a killer, but as a wife suddenly discovering her husband had died unexpectedly. Well, if that were the case, don't you think you'd call 911 a little sooner than within 15 minutes? Like, that seems kind of like a stretch to me. But a huge portion of the defense closing argument focused on criticizing the investigation itself. Wendy Lewis argued investigators decided early on that Corey was guilty and then worked backward to try to prove it, basically using confirmation bias. And they, you know, explained what that is, yada, yada. I think you guys know what confirmation bias is, but if you don't, it's basically looking up information that supports your theory and disregarding anything that goes against it. So Wendy Lewis argued that the house was never treated as a homicide scene. She said investigators did not secure the house. They did not conduct a full search, only searched limited areas initially. And she told jurors that Corey even gave permission to search certain areas, but officers did not ask to search the entire home. She said the entire house could have been searched that day, but they didn't even ask. According to the defense, investigators later returned to the home multiple times over several years, still looking for evidence. She told the jury they were still searching for evidence 2 weeks before trial. So her point was that after years of searching, investigators never found the alleged murder weapon or the source of the fentanyl. In other words, she argued the state never proved how the drug got into Eric's body. And I will say that part made me nervous because I too felt like the state didn't didn't prove that she put the fentanyl in the cup. I think you just had to have common sense to surmise that, obviously. But I was worried because we've seen this happen with Casey Anthony. You know, they were not able to prove exactly how Kaylee died and exactly when she died and all of that. And so this jury decided not to convict her based on technicalities. I was just really afraid of that happening again here, but thankfully it didn't. But one of the most emotional portions of the defense's closing argument involved Corey's behavior after Eric died. Throughout the trial, prosecutors pointed to things that they believed showed suspicious behavior, including smiling, joking, or appearing calm. And Wendy kind of pushed back on that, saying, "Can we not smile in our grief?" And she told the jury that people react to trauma differently and there's no single correct way to behave after losing a spouse. And we're obviously seeing a lot of this too with like the Erica Kirk situation. Everyone's kind of criticizing her for how she's grieving or not grieving. But I think it's pretty obvious, like when someone seems really overwhelmed by grief and when someone just is acting bizarrely. And of course it's going to draw attention because it's bizarre, which the basic premise of bizarre is that it's unnatural. It's not normal. It's not average, not common. Like, of course we're going to comment on it. So then she turned to a visual theme that was introduced earlier in the trial. And it was this picture of either a witch or a widow. The prosecution had suggested that Corey was essentially a black widow, referencing a woman who kills her husband, which is based on the spider, the black spider with the little red thing on its back that is known for killing its like partners or something like that. Well, Wendy countered that framing of Corey directly. She displayed an image of Corey on the floor of the morning Eric died and asked the jury, "Is this a witch or a widow?" She said the prosecution wants jurors to see a villain, but the defense wants them to see a grieving spouse. She finally concluded her argument by reminding jurors of the legal standards that they must follow. Again, kind of like a Jose Baez move. She told them that the prosecution's case relies heavily on assumptions and speculation. The state's theory, she said, asks jurors to make leaps, to assume Corey obtained fentanyl, to assume she administered it, and to assume she intended to kill Eric. But the defense argued the state never actually proved those things. She ended by returning again to reasonable doubt, that if jurors believe there is any other possible explanation for Eric's death, including the possibility that he ingested fentanyl without Corey's involvement, then the law requires them to acquit. And with that message, the defense finished its closing argument and handed the case to the jury. And then the jury only deliberated for less than 3 hours. I was shocked. So I think it was 5:30. So I'm in Central Standard Time. They are Mountain Time, which I think is 1 hour ahead. So at 5:30, they said they were going to stay into the evening and they wanted 30 more minutes to determine if they were going to keep deliberating or come back the next day, which already indicated to me that they were close. And so by the time 30 minutes rolled around, they said, "We have a verdict," and it was going to be read within the next 30 minutes. So that would have been 6:20 Mountain Time. They delivered the verdict. And so here again is the audio of Judge Mrazek reading the verdict to Corey. When she hears this verdict, her mouth opens up just a tiny bit, like she's kind of shocked or gasping a little bit, and then just kind of drops her head and looks down. The rest of the time, she did not emote at all. She didn't look at the jury. She didn't cry. She didn't do anything. She just stared off into space. Just much like she did the entire trial. Like, I don't know what I expected. I thought I would see some actual tears, but I think the only way she would have cried is if she was found not guilty, because she would have been so elated that she got away with it. So anyway, here again is that audio.
Count one, aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously agree that the prosecution has proved the following circumstance or circumstances regarding count one beyond a reasonable doubt. The homicide was committed for pecuniary gain, and the homicide was committed by means of the administration of any substance administered in a lethal amount, dosage, or quantity. Count two, attempted aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of attempted aggravated murder. We, the jury, unanimously agree the prosecution has proved the following circumstances or circumstances regarding count two beyond a reasonable doubt. The attempted homicide was committed for pecuniary gain. Count three, insurance fraud. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of insurance fraud. Count four, insurance fraud. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of insurance fraud. Count five, forgery. We, the jury, unanimously find that the defendant, Corey Richens, is guilty of forgery. It's signed by the four person. Please have a seat. Madam four person, is this the verdict that the jury reached unanimously?
Yes, it is.
Okay, you may have a seat. Ms. Lewis, Ms. Nestor, do you wish the jury to be polled?
Yes, please.
All right. Folks, I'll ask you the same yes or no question, one at a time, starting on my left, working this way. Front row first, if you could show me your lanyard number as I ask you. Juror number five, is this the verdict you voted in favor of?
Yes.
Juror number four, is this the verdict you voted in favor of?
Yes.
Juror number three.
Yes.
I can't see your number, I'm so sorry. The four person, I just need to ask you again, I'm sorry. Juror number two.
Yes, it is.
Juror number one.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sir. Juror number eight.
Yes.
Juror number seven.
Yes, it is.
Juror number six.
Yes.
All right. Counsel, is there anything further on this case before the jury is discharged? Mr. Bloodworth.
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Ms. Lewis.
No, Your Honor.
After the reading of the verdict, they discussed sentencing scheduling. They did not have any open days in April, so Corey Richens is scheduled to be sentenced on May 13th at 9:30 a.m. The sentencing date coincides with what would have been her husband's 44th birthday. And I think it's safe to assume that she will spend the rest of her life in prison. Thank you so much for listening to my coverage of the Corey Richens trial. I really enjoyed doing this. If you enjoy trial coverage like this, then let me know what your thoughts are in this entire experience. And if you have a story that you want to recommend to me or a trial that you think I should follow or recap, please let me know at mamamystery.com. Scroll down to that white box. Let me know who you are, though. If you don't tell me who you are or a way to respond to you, then I can't. So don't forget that part, because people do often. All right. Have a great rest of your week, y'all. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.